Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Webb, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Chad Riley.
Just call me a guppy.
Okay. And our other co-host, Spencer Williams. A guppy?
I'm just trying to swim along.
Well, I'm still Spencer, so let's stick with that.
There we go. We got a great show for you in store as we're going to be talking about the recently released film, Kin. Started as an independent film and has made it to the big screen, and we are going to jab about it because...
Why?
I don't...
Why?
I don't know.
Why?
Let's talk about something that makes sense. Chad, why don't you give him a little bit of info?
Okay, even in a frostbitten, futuristic, alternate dimension, the Filmlosophers will never fail to be brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios. That's right, we'll never be rid of them.
Nope.
Don't misplace your most valuable possessions, our newest podcast episodes, of course. Subscribe to the Filmlosophers on your favorite streaming platforms, including Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM and Audio Boom. New episodes drop each Wednesday morning. Spencer, where else can they find us?
Set your comments to stun and let us know what's on your mind. Like our page on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. When you're ready for hours of enjoyment, don't watch this movie at all. But make sure you visit our website at filmlosophers.com to access our library of more than 100 episodes.
That's right. We got a website. You can head over there at filmlosophers.com where you can check out all our great episodes. We had an awesome episode on, oddly enough, Sharknado 6.
Such a fun one.
It was a really good one.
Pretty good.
Chad kind of threw the entire script out the window, and we just had a great time. So if you want to hear all that goodness, head over to that episode right after you listen to this one. But before you do... listen in as we talk a little bit about Kin. Here's the thing. Before we jump into this movie, I just have to ask, why was this movie made? I mean, really, was there a reason at all? I mean, here's the thing. As you're hearing the music play right now, the music sounds inviting. The music sounds really good. This is like one of those bait and switch things where you're hearing like really incredible music, you're looking at stunning visuals, and you're like, oh, this is going to be great. Now, here's the thing for me. I'm a huge sci-fi nerd. Like, I love science fiction films. From everything from 2001, A Space Odyssey, all the way up until Arrival, 2016's Arrival. Yeah. I am... a huge advocate for the sci-fi genre because it doesn't get as much credit as it should. This was an opportunity to shine a bit in that particular genre. And so I went in not really knowing much. And I don't know.
You know, it's interesting because, full disclosure, we were really hoping for a press screening to see Peppermint with Jennifer Garner. And it never came through for us. So we ended up just sort of Rochambeauing with what's in the theater right now. And ended up with this one. I don't think any of us knew very much about this movie.
Nope.
At all. Once we decided to see it, we all watched the trailer. But aside from that, there really wasn't much to go on. And I think after having seen the movie, I still really hope that press screening for Peppermint is going to come through.
So with that said... like I said, we're going to be talking about the movie Kin. Chad, give him that official synopsis. I'm not even going to say goodness. Just give him the synopsis.
All right. Chased by a vengeful criminal and a gang of otherworldly soldiers, a recently released ex-con and his adopted teenage brother are forced to go on the run with a weapon of mysterious origin as their only protection.
Directed by brothers Jonathan and Josh Baker, the film stars Jack Rayner, Zoe Kravitz, Carrie Coon, Dennis Quaid, James Franco, and Miles Truitt. The film is adapted from a short feature, as we mentioned earlier, previously directed by the brothers. And it was a short film that was done back in 2014 called Bagman.
Which we've also watched.
We also saw that. If you haven't had a chance to, the short film is available on YouTube. So if you look up Bagman in lieu of the film being released this past weekend, it's all over YouTube, so you can check it out there. So, yeah, like I said, we got a chance to see this film in an empty theater, no less.
There were six of us.
After the movie had started.
There was one guy that walked in about halfway through, and I think he probably got as much out of it as we did that were in there the whole time.
True. So we got a chance to go check this film out, and like I said, one of the big things for me, I'm a huge sci-fi nerd. I was really hoping, because with a lot of the science fiction films that are coming in, we get maybe like one good one every few years. Mm-hmm. Like the last great one that came through was Arrival. I mean, you have your more, what is it, mainstream sci-fis. Like you have your Star Treks, your Star
right,
Wars.
Yeah.
You have a lot of that, and that's fine and dandy and all. That's good.
They're definitely that's keeping the genre popular for the mass market.
Yeah,
but it's not one of those like distinctive pieces that's like, oh, I remember the first time I saw, you know, whatever, like Arrival in the theater.
Yeah. Like
that movie changed my life a little bit.
Oh, 100%.
It was so interesting.
That movie was one of the highlights of the 2010 decade so far. Like, we're in 2018 right now, and still that film stands, you know, miles above a lot of the sci-fi films that have come out in this decade.
And it's a great example of a good bait and switch, because you think it's one thing,
yeah,
and then you're sitting there going through it, and you're like, oh, this is actually not the movie that I thought that it was. It's a better movie than what I thought it was,
as opposed to this one. And you look at a lot of the films that have come down in the sci-fi genre, things like we said, 2016's Arrival. You look at 2004's Primer, which is a great film talking about time travel. You look at even 2014's Synchronicity, which is a great film. All these films really exemplify what it means to be in that sci-fi genre. I mean, when I think sci-fi, first off, I immediately think literature, you know, and I think, you know, the great works by like H.P. Lovecraft and a lot of these novels that really just exemplified what it meant to be science fiction. I mean, the most original science fiction novel out there
established it, yeah, as a genre,
yeah,
to adapt
exactly
for film.
You know, you look at things like, and a lot of people equate this more to like horror, but you look at film or books like Frankenstein's Monster, you know, and that's actually a science fiction book, in my opinion, because it's about science. Obviously,
absolutely,
it's about reanimating the dead, but that's kind of the afterthought of this is about science. This is about the, you know, achievements in this area. And so you kind of have to hold a high, you know, set of standards for films like this. I mean, you could have your mainstreams, and those are fine for the masses. That's all cool. I mean, everybody can have theirs. But when it comes to, like, real sci-fi, when it comes to real things like that, I really expect a lot, in my opinion. And that just may make me a sci-fi sci-fi snob. But, oh, well, I don't care.
I would agree, especially when you're talking about a story that doesn't weigh super, super heavily on like spectacle in the sense of, well, in this day and age, computer generated graphics, you know, green screen environments that are then completely transformed into something else. Like, I think science fiction with that very tactile, visceral kind of quality to it, mm-hmm, where it matters how the set itself, the physical set, is designed. It matters how the costumes work. It matters how you light the scene. Like a good film, any genre.
Yeah.
When those elements are there and the science fiction angle, if you will, whether it's the monster or the tech or the shift in time or the shift in place or whatever that mechanic is, that's sort of an accent mark,
oh, yeah,
on something that's already rich, developed, and fairly deep all on its own as a story that we as humans can relate to.
Yeah.
And one of the things that had a chance of working with this movie was that there was a very visceral, you know, lived in kind of mise-en-scene, if you will, like the way that what you see through the camera lens, the way the scene looks, because you've got, you know, some very rich layered sets or locations. You've got the skeleton, at least, of a family drama that's bound to be relatable at some level for most people.
Yeah.
And you've got this accent mark that is the gun that looks like it does a couple of cool things, but it doesn't overpower the film. Like, it doesn't transport you to another world or turn you into an alien creature or anything like that.
So I want to kind of turn this conversation real quick, and I want to know, so Spencer, what is your experience with sci-fi? Where do you sit in that particular genre? Are you a fan of it? Could you do without? Are you more of like a romantic comedy kind of guy? Are you the one who gets all excited for the next Bollywood film? I mean, what's your jam here? What's going on?
I am a big science fiction person.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
My dad grew me up on the original Lost in Space and Star Trek The Next Gen.
Now, when you say the original Lost in Space, you're not talking about that one with Matt LeBlanc, are you?
No, I'm talking about the 1960s one.
To some people out there that are listening,
that is not the
original.
That
is their original, so that's where they...
I thought it didn't start until Netflix.
There you go. See? People are learning stuff. Spence, continue.
Yeah, so no, that's how like I start off with sci-fi, and then you know I just grew from there because like I just love like the adventure of like you know space and like sciencey stuff that can do weird things, like take you to different dimensions, like Sliders. That was a good one.
Fox's Sliders.
Back when they had some talent.
Back when they actually let a show live longer than a season or two.
Yeah, so there's lots of sci-fi that I just really love.
So you have a history in it, saying. You have a good enough history to kind of base what you see in the future off of your knowledge prior to.
Yeah, most definitely.
So you have a good base. That's good. I mean, the original Lost in Space series was, you know, ahead of its time. In an era where the space race was a real big deal and people wanted to go the distance with, you know, between Russia and America. And it's a great example of the adventures that one could have if they do achieve that kind of thing. So it was really cool. What about you, Chad? I know you are a very well-versed individual in film because Chad has a huge collection at his house. But I don't know if we've ever sat down and talked about your views on the sci-fi genre. I know I did have the glorious honor of sitting next to Chad when we first saw Arrival, and that was a great film to just enjoy and relish for the first time sitting next to Chad. It was great. But aside from that, I don't know really where you sit on the sci-fi genre itself.
Yeah, quick plug for our own content. We did review Arrival in Lesson 37. So if you visit filmlosophers.com and scroll all the way down to Lesson 37, which was quite a while ago, you can take a listen to the whole thing. But I would definitely rank sci-fi as probably one of my top three genres.
Okay.
Right up there with historic epics, because I love Gladiator, Braveheart, all that mess. I mean, even like 300 and sort of Clash of the Titans a little bit. It gets a little campy. Not the old version, the new version, but both of them are really campy. But like any kind of swords and sandals thing, like I'm all for that. I will chew through books. But
it's
sci-fi
true.
Is
Netflix
definitely
is
there
filled
with
all those types of movies.
Oh, absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. I was one of the few people who watched their entire Troy series that they partnered with the BBC to do, and I thought it was really well done. So you can lambast me about that later, but I thought that was fantastic. The sci-fi genre is definitely up there among my favorites. My favorite television show in the history of television is the revamped Battlestar Galactica. Ron Moore's, you know, take on that. I thought it was just the smartest, most fulfilling, even with its pitfalls, which there were several, but most fulfilling series I've ever seen. It was bold. It was daring. It did things with the genre that are like, in my opinion, the sci-fi genre works best when it's behaving as a cipher for our actual real world issues. So mm-hmm. when they talked about things on certain episodes of Battlestar Galactica that related to the war on terror, related to beliefs about whether or not to seek medical, like professional medical assistance for your kids, you know, or different medical treatments, different societal problems, that when you couch it in terms of, you know, terrifying robots hunting humans to extinction and how are we going to survive, and, you know, all this very big space drama kind of stuff, you can sort of slide these really important discussions in at a slant, and people will actually engage with it in ways that if you tried to have a, like a town hall meeting or some sort of political debate or even a modern day sitcom sort of scenario or hour drama, people, their hackles would be raised already. They wouldn't be willing to always engage in that kind of healthy dialogue or, you know, can I actually see the other side's point of view? I don't have to agree with it, but am I even willing to look? And a lot of people get really dug in, but then you get something like sci-fi or you get fantasy or you get an animated format, and suddenly, because it's a fantastical backdrop and there are lasers and dragons and whatever else happening, suddenly you get a lot of leeway to bring up really important issues, you know, that might, they might not change people's opinions, but they might at least enlarge the scope of the discussion for them. And I think that's a really healthy beat to take. And it's a groove that most entertainment products don't succeed in. I thought Battlestar did a great job, for the most part, kind of settling into that groove and having that realism to it, even though there was a lot of science fiction fantasy. All that to say, this movie, I think that there was a lot of potential. I mean, looking at it now, having seen it, there was a lot of potential. I think, honestly, most of that potential was squandered. Mm-hmm. And by the end of this movie, you see the movie that, the promise of a movie that you should have seen instead.
Yeah.
Which is a really, really rough thing to make it an hour and a half through this. And then by the end, you're like, wait a minute, I would watch that movie. Like that movie has a little bit more oomph to it. This one kind of just coasts on fumes a bit. Well, not even a bit, quite a lot. But anyway, I don't want to take away from your input, Eddie, having already declared yourself a devotee of the sci-fi genre. What kind of backing do you bring to
King
this discussion?
King of the sci-fi nerds over here.
Oh, well, I mean, my sci-fi runs as far as 1937's Metropolis, one of my favorite films.
Okay.
German film. That was one of the first films I remember watching as a kid. I remember how excited I was finding out in the mid-90s that they found additional footage that was missing within the middle of the film. I love sci-fi. Sci-fi is in my top two. It's horror film and sci-fi in terms of my top two. There's none of them, not one takes over the other. They're both equally. And sometimes they overlap really well, which is why I like them both. I mean, you look at something like Alien and Aliens. That's a sci-fi film, but it also can double as a horror film because
absolutely.
Of the way the creature works and the dynamic of the film and the antagonist, if you will. So they work hand in hand, which is why I like them so well. But I've been fortunate enough to have seen so many movies through my lifetime that sci-fi played a huge role in why I love cinema so much. As I mentioned, you know, I'm a huge fan of things like Stanley Kubrick's films, everything from Ridley Scott and even some of Tony Scott's work, a lot of what Guillermo del Toro has done, a lot of what Denis Villeneuve did with Arrival. I'm a huge fan of just the genre itself, which is why, oddly enough, and I didn't know it at the time when we looked up one of the channels, I remember actually when that particular YouTube channel, it's called Dust, so if you haven't heard of it, you should check it out. I actually remember when it started out and they had reached out to us to talk about some stuff, but they're huge advocates for sci-fi as well, and I've like chewed through most of their videos because they have great stuff. So I really enjoy the genre, to kind of sum it up. So,
but can you convincingly expound upon Plan 9 from Outer Space?
That's not the with real the time question we have right now.
That movie's amazing.
Oh my gosh. But to say all that, here's the thing. Like I said earlier, we get maybe one or two good sci-fi films every few years. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those opportunities where this could have been a good sci-fi film. I will give it that. It's an interesting premise, but I think it was poorly executed. And I think there are so many things that could have gone right that just went wrong. But I digress. Before we jump into it, what are some of your guys's, what was your biggest expectation before coming into this film, Spence? Like, what were you thinking out of the trailer?
When I originally saw the trailer for this movie, I made sure to check our list of what we were going to see for the year and making sure that movie was not on it. And then, you know, we had to go see it. So I was super bummed about that. The trailer did not really super impress me and kind of had me concerned about what the movie was going to cover, because it's about a black kid finding a gun and then the government's involved, and I was hoping there was not going to be some stupid scene in this movie, which there's not, of like, you know, some cop shooting the black kid, because that would have been a whole big ordeal. And I'm happy they did not do that and had the sense not to. But what? Oh gosh.
We'll get into that in a little bit. Chad, what about you? What are some of your expectations?
Okay.
What was one?
I saw the trailer shortly before we went and saw the movie, a couple days before, and I thought, okay, I can kind of get behind this. I mean, the gun looks pretty cool. Like the way that the I don't know, the HUD overlay kind of on this box. I mean, it's a very nondescript weapon until you add all the bells and whistles, and what it can do, and that's all pretty well foreshadowed. That's actually like telegraphed to you in the trailer. You see almost every really cool use of the gun in the trailer. As it turns out, I was hoping for more in the movie itself. But so yeah, I definitely, I am an older brother. I, even with like friends and extended family, like I feel that brotherly role is a very defining part of who I am, and I vibe with that whenever it shows up in films, whether it's done well or not. And so the fact that this movie had that very interesting atypical brother relationship, where you've got a significantly older brother who's just getting out of prison, and then a significantly younger adopted brother who's, you know, getting in trouble in school and whatever, but otherwise, you know, trying to live a good life, follow the lead of his parents. And, you know, that was an interesting dynamic. I thought, you know, the whole, like, brothers bonding, coming of age, getting to know each other, you know, going on this crazy escape adventure thing. The trailer didn't make it super clear exactly what happens to make them go on the run.
Yeah.
There's like an alien or futuristic soldier kind of vibe for some of the people that are pursuing this weapon. And then there's another vibe of like this greasy, you know, underbelly of society gang leader played by James Franco, who's also chasing them, and the two don't appear to be in cahoots. The futuristic alien person and greaseball Franco don't seem to like associate with each other, but they're both chasing these boys. And, you know, so anyway, there was some intrigue for me there. I definitely thought, having watched the trailer, I'm like, okay, well, I mean, if we can't go see Peppermint, then okay, I can probably find some things to enjoy here. I was mostly incorrect. But, you know, kudos to the people who made the trailer. They made it look somewhat interesting. And yeah, after watching the whole movie, they didn't have a whole lot to work with.
No, I completely agree. In fact, they should have hired them to make the film instead of them just make the trailer, because whatever they did in the trailer was a lot more interesting. Here's the thing for me. A couple things that this film did that already raised a red flag. Number one is the first thing that I saw was what Spencer had mentioned. It's essentially a film about a kid who finds a gun and it's cool. You know, I'm not really. That's the first strike.
The second, it's not cool. It's the call of destiny.
And then the second part is they made it a little black boy.
Mm-hmm.
Where I immediately went to where Spencer was thinking in terms of like, dude, that's all this kid needs. I don't know where he's at, but I'm sure he's going to get looked at. Mm. I mean, he could just be looked at just for having a bag with that size of something in there. And then thirdly, the third strike was obviously James Franco. I'm not a big fan.
The third strike was obviously James Franco.
So I was hoping for a lot more to come out of the film from what I saw in the trailer, because the trailer wasn't promising much. Like, I was really hoping that this wasn't just going to be an updated version of Star Kid, which was a mid-90s movie starring the kid from Jurassic Park who finds this alien armor and can do all this crazy stuff or whatever. I was hoping it just wasn't an updated version of that. So that was all my expectations laid out in, like, the three strikes you're out kind of thing. I still went to go see it, mind you. And
Begrudgingly so.
So as we
Got into the theater and literally we were the only people in there until a few others joined us. And I think you pretty much did a Facebook Live about how empty the theater was and how that was, you know, validation of your three strikes. You're like, yes, other people knew not to come here.
Yeah, because I actually did an Instagram story real quick. And the theater was empty as the lights were going down. And that was like the first red flag actually being in the theater. Like, oh no. Why didn't we check Rotten Tomatoes first? So, I mean,
hey, beggars can't be choosers when we don't do press screenings.
So true. So as we dive into the film, as Chad mentioned, the film is essentially about a young boy who's adopted into a family. There's only a father, played by Dennis Quaid. Dennis Quaid is taking care of the kid. Kid has issues in school. There's a brother who comes in who had been in prison for a few years, I guess. Yep. 6 years? 7 years?
Six. Yeah.
And he apparently owes money to James Franco, who looks really bad in this movie. Like, I don't know if, like, he just woke up and like, all right, let's shoot this thing. All right. And just rolled out. I feel like that's what he did.
That's kind of the feeling you get, for sure.
And then there's Zoe Kravitz, whom they meet later down the road and whatnot.
Stripper with a heart of gold. That is literally what she is.
That is literally no joke. What she is.
This movie is poor decisions, the movie. There's so many poor decisions from a director and, like, writing standpoint, and also an in-movie logic of, oh, yeah, this is a great idea. It just had me scratching my head the whole time.
Yeah, it definitely, I think for me, I agree. It had me scratching my head. The thing that really threw me off was the look of it. I was convinced until a very specific point, I was convinced that this movie was set in the late 1980s and it just didn't tell us that. Like, it was going to reveal to us. We were supposed to pick up on the fact that everything looked old. And then they had that, you know, cliche, well, not, I don't want to offend anybody who has kids and does this, but the growth chart that you do on the door jamb,
mm-hmm.
and it's got one kid's mark and then the other kid's mark and then the first kid's mark and the second kid's mark to show how they grew. And the dates on the growth chart are modern day, like contemporary dates.
Yeah.
But everything else about the look and feel of the movie, until one character finally pulls out a cell phone, it all feels old and mm-hmm. and justifiably so. Like, okay, futuristic alien otherworldly weapon comes into our world from we don't know where.
Yeah.
That could happen in the 1800s, cowboys versus aliens. Hello. I mean, it doesn't matter when you set it.
Yeah.
As long as you pay it off well. And I was convinced that there was something else going on that turns out that was just me occupying my time.
No, I mean, mentally, it totally makes
sense.
There
wasn't anything else going on.
No, but your logic totally makes sense because of the fact that this film feels like, because I believe it's Detroit that it's based in.
Yes, it is.
It feels like
Detroit, in the beginning, at least.
In the beginning. It feels like Detroit is in this bubble, like this time war bubble, because everybody is driving these older cars.
Like every car on every street is older.
Yeah. And it's like the filmmakers thought, well, let's paint a picture of Detroit as like so behind the times. And, you know, when they find this new, you know, piece of technology, it's going to totally like blow them away, you know, figuratively as well as literally. And, you know, and they're going to go, ooh, and ah, and, you know, we'll do all this. And then they mess it up by leaving Detroit and realizing the rest of the world is like in now.
Except most of what they show is still feels old.
Yeah.
Almost all of it. There was one scene in like the basement or the living room of James Franco's character's like base of operations that shows people playing video games on a modern console, on a modern like flat screen television. There was maybe a couple of different cell phones that both looked old, outdated, and there's a casino near the end that has some accoutrements that may skew early 2000s. Other than that, it all feels like the 1980s.
It really does. Like even at the part where there's a part where there's a police station, there's a whole like, you know, these cops are coming out of nowhere and arresting people, and they're all carrying like revolvers.
Yeah.
Nobody's carrying like an actual, you know, Glock or anything or whatever most cops nowadays use. They're all using like six shooter revolvers here. I'm like, that might be an issue. I mean, there might be more than six guys. I'm just saying. This movie is confusing.
There aren't, but still somehow the police are outnumbered.
Oh, 100%. So ultimately, this little boy who's has trouble in school finds this otherworldly box that seems to activate when he touches it. And
well, first he finds a bunch of dead bodies.
He finds a bunch of Master Chiefs lying on the floor. Apparently, there was a big Halo match, and everybody that didn't respawn ended up on the floor in this place. And they all do. They all look like Master Chief.
Yeah, they
Chief.
Do. They look like really knockoff Master Chief costumes.
Exactly. And so I'm like, okay, whatever. I can look past this. And he ends up finding this one piece of technology that reacts to him, and he gets scared, runs away, comes back later and picks it up. And he takes it home, and he's wielding it. And my first red flag after watching this film, after the film started, mind you, there's already a red flag before because no one's in the theater by this point. Another red flag that came up, the film is highlighting this little boy looking in a mirror and showing off his gun to himself, like how he looks with the gun. And I'm like, yeah, that's what you want to show off to the kids that come and see this film. Showing off this kid like, oh, you want to mess with my family? Look what I got. I got, you know, oh, you're saying something? Oh, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, because that's how you deal with bullies. You guys know that, right? That's how you deal with bullies. You got to have a weapon.
See, I didn't have as much of a problem with that because I was very distracted by the fact that his pose in the mirror versus his pose standing in his room were completely different. Like what he thought he saw in the mirror of himself versus the him that he actually was in his room, they were two completely different poses. It was sort of like watching Smeagol and Gollum in The Two Towers, where he's talking to himself, but at first you don't see him, you don't see the actual transition. You see the two different characters, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like that, and I thought, oh, I wonder what they're going to do with this, because that's actually kind of clever. Like, he's got the bravado in the mirror, but then he's got his actual self. The gun was pointed down. Like, he didn't have it raised in a heroic posture. He had it in a protective stance, like you would if you're being responsible with a firearm, you know, like at a shooting range or something, not in your bedroom. But I thought that it was an interesting visual juxtaposition that they were going to do something with. And again, I was thinking too hard. I was giving a little too much credit. Or if they did mean something by it, they didn't really pay it off.
And mind you, this is a little kid, so I'll give him that. You know, maybe, you know, he was still working.
He's
out.
14.
He's 14. So, but moving on to the other characters in the film, you have Dennis Quaid, who plays the father, who apparently just is everybody's dad. Dennis Quaid is like everybody's dad from The Rookie to I Can Only Imagine recently, mm-hmm, to this film. It's like Dennis Quaid fathered all these children in Hollywood, and he's just coming back now in his old age to make things right. I feel like, because Dennis Quaid always plays a good. I'm not gonna lie, I wouldn't be opposed to having Dennis Quaid adopt me. I would, you know, I wouldn't mind at all. I would love to have Dennis Quaid be my dad. I have a great dad, mind you. Don't. Dad, if you're listening, I'm just playing.
Oh, you know he's listening. He listens to every episode.
Doing lots
Come on.
Of backtracking now.
I'm just saying, he's a really interesting guy, Dennis Quaid, and he just always seems to play the same person, and I think he's kind of losing a little bit of the juice of playing the dad role. Like, I feel like he's getting tired, or at least it felt like he was tired in this role, because he's like, all right, time to phone it in.
Well, I thought he was doing that on purpose, because he was supposed to be portraying, like, it's a really hard life, and I'm tired from my hard life, and my kids, and my wife's dead, and that kind of stuff.
Which is essentially the premise of
the film. That captures basically everything you need to know about the character.
And then you have the son who gets out of prison, who feels oh my gosh, he felt like he got back from, like, the spa, or he came back from vacation.
Summer camp. I was thinking summer camp.
He's like, hey guys, how's it going? I'm back. Hey, you know, yeah, you know, prison will do that to you, blah, blah, blah. I'm like,
no.
What?
He was not in prison.
He was like at like a, I don't know. He was somewhere. He was at the Peace, with the Peace Corps or something. I don't know. He did not seem like he was in prison.
He wasn't.
I don't know. That just rubbed me the wrong way. As soon as he walked through the door, he's like, oh, yeah, hey, guys. Well, prison will do that
to you.
Well,
hold on. Okay, time out, though. Uh-huh. The writing in this movie was awful. Like, it was garbo writing. And yes, a truly, like, a deeply talented performer should be able to transform even garbo dialogue and pacing and whatever into something mediocre. It's not entirely his fault. I think it was miscast, but it's not entirely his fault that the way that his scenes were written were terrible. Mm-hmm. And he makes, like, less than zero sense. He does. He waffles between two or three different states of being from, like, one moment to the next, and not in an intriguing way. Like, not in a way that makes you feel like it was intentional.
Oh, it was not.
It's just sort of like, well, we're going to have him do this. That's what it feels like.
Here's the thing. This particular actor, and I'm not saying he's typecast, but this is what he's played previously. Jack Rayner, if you don't know, he was the older brother in Sing Street. He was like, whatever, I'm gonna smoke pot and do whatever I want. You should listen to this music, blah, blah, blah. In Detroit, I don't know if you guys remember Detroit, but he was one of the officers who just followed blindly with everything that the other guys were doing. It seems like this character...
Transformers, he was the bad boy, like, guy that Mark Wahlberg didn't want his daughter dating.
Was that him?
Yeah, that was him.
The Cochino. That's the guy who was like, oh yeah, the Romeo and Juliet law. Is that him?
Yeah, that's him.
He's a dirtbag. Now I don't like him even more. Oh, I hated that movie for that particular reason. Why is Michael Bay so fixated on... Okay, we're not going to get into that conversation, because Transformers is just garbo. But obviously this guy seems like he's the type of person who needs to be led while on screen. Like, he needs to have somebody kind of... Either he's super lackadaisical and is just sitting down and not doing anything, or he's somebody who has to be, like, led, like, oh, you got to follow these guys and do what they're doing in this role. I don't see him as, like, the standout performer that can, you know, really turn the tide of a film. And this is one of those instances where I think the kid did more of the leading than the brother.
Most definitely.
And I felt just every single scene that he tried to make seem important or valuable. The only reason why I was watching was because of the kid's reaction. I could care less what he was saying, because he didn't seem like very... He seemed pouty. He was very Anakin. He was a very Anakin type of character. Like, I hate the sand. It gets everywhere. It's so dirty. And that's what I felt like with this guy. I'm like,
hey, we'll stop you when you're wrong.
I mean, yeah. I just...
Keep going.
And then you move from that to, what was I thinking of next? And then Zoe Kravitz's character is just out of left field. Like, okay, stripper.
Like, by the time you see her character, number one, it's been about an hour and it feels like four. And by the time you see her, I was like, oh, I forgot your name was in the opening credits. And I made note of it. Like, oh, you're in this movie. Yeah. And for whatever reason, she kind of has a meaningful-ish part, but it completely doesn't match anything that's happening or any form of logic for a human being.
I'd have to disagree. I don't think she played any... Like, I don't think... This was the type of role where I felt like it didn't have to be Zoe Kravitz, number one. And number two, I don't think it had to be a stripper. Like,
It most definitely did not have to be a stripper.
Nor did it have to be Zoe Kravitz. They needed something to help kind of reground the character of the little boy of Elijah.
Yeah.
Like, he needed something to give him some firm footing again because his whole world was upside down and he didn't know the truth and he didn't know why. So, like, formatically, structurally speaking, you needed an element to help get him back on Earth in a way and help him feel solid ground under his feet. And that's the role that her character plays, among other things. But everything they chose to do with that role was a total mistake.
And a total waste of her talent, in all honesty. So that's pretty much what I'm going to do with that, with Zoe Kravitz. I'm not going to go any further because she's literally there. She's gone the next and shows up back towards another point. Whatever. Jumping over to the hillbilly of this film, James Franco.
Your fave.
I don't know the hillbilly
of this film.
He seemed like the, I don't know, man. It's like, I don't want to hate the way this guy performs, but I really strongly don't like the way this guy performs. Like, you take something like the Disaster Artist. He completely disappeared in that. And that was great.
Yeah, he was great.
I can still see James Franco in everything else that he does because in my mind, I can literally picture James Franco acting like that. This guy has looks like he got a haircut from a weed whacker.
Yeah.
And he looks like he's got two discolored eyes. And this guy just pees on everything. Literally, he's like...
I love how your rant against his acting prowess is his character design and one thing that he does, which is pee on the floor.
I was just talking about the man himself. I wasn't even talking about the role.
Oh, God.
No. But it seems like this guy... It's like, okay, what's the worst type of person you could think of? Be that and more, and we're not going to even try to stop you. Like, just in the film, just do whatever you want until you feel like, just go ham wild. And it's like, his character is literally given free reign in this world. Like, he can't be stopped. He is like the OP. He is in the God mode.
True.
In this film. Because
totally agree.
He literally walks into a police station, says, hey, is that one guy here, that degenerate here, and his little kid brother? And he's like, oh, I can't even tell you that. Okay. And then he walks over and just walks to the door. Who does that?
Okay, we have to come back to the police thing later because there's so many issues with just the police station scene alone.
And I think it goes back to also the caliber of actors and acting and whatnot, because much like the brother, there's a lot of instances in this film where, like, the acting was just horrible.
Mm-hmm. Boo-boo.
Take, for instance, his dead brother.
James Franco's
James Franco brother.
Can we talk about the funeral for the brother? Because yes. I was looking at the background characters and got confused instantly.
Yeah, I didn't know if they were supposed to be like an Amish community. Are they
it's
a cult.
Was it like a gypsy cult?
It's like an urban gypsy
because
cult.
Because like he's like this
from the 1980s.
He's supposed to be this hard gangster and stuff, and he's with his gang members,
Yeah.
But then there's two that little granny's girls hardcore. And an old man and an old woman in like a suit.
When it started, I thought that he had taken like Dennis Quaid's parents and some other family members. Like, I can't get to these brothers, so I'm taking other members of their family and I'm going to throw them into the fire or something.
Which would actually make sense for
but
him.
But that's not what it was. It was this weird, like, cult gang family funeral mourning time thing with an odd story that didn't make any sense. And like the worst shot of a dead body performer ever. As soon as it zoomed in on his face, you saw the throat go.
His Adam's apple went.
His Adam
and a half into the air.
His Adam's apple went to the top floor and to the bottom floor at the same time.
It's like the second they zoomed in on him. I'm like, yeah. Pick a different take.
Like, couldn't you have gone it twice? And that entire
dude,
scene.
Stop breathing.
It looked like. So I don't know if you guys ever saw. There was a show called Outsiders. It was literally about the people who lived in the mountains who made moonshine.
Yeah, I remember
that's
you watching
what this
that.
Film. That's what this scene looked like. I felt like he was a moonshiner in the middle of Detroit in the 1980s with his lawnmower haircut and his, you know, unbroken, housebroken, whatever issues that he had, his incontinence and his discolored eyes and his this was a bad scene. This was a bad movie. I'm sorry. I just have to say, this movie is one of those types of films where, as a member of the sci-fi community who enjoys it and just relishes it, this should be buried. Like, wherever they buried, like, all those Atari cartridges of E.T. Like, wherever they sent in a rocket ship hurling straight for the sun. I mean, this film should just go.
Well, really, it feels like the main problem of this film is they made a sequel for this movie, and it's like, oh man, it'd probably be better if we had a backstory, and then they made this movie, and it doesn't make any sense.
Until the very, 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 very end, when you get the glimmer of what could have been a better, more interesting story altogether.
Which is weird why they even had a glimmer in this movie.
Like, why did you do that? You broke both sides of that equation.
100%. This film, here's the thing, and we've talked about it before on this show. Here's the biggest issue this film has.
James Franco.
Well, that too. Here's the second biggest issue with the film.
Can I just, before you do that, this is my brief rant.
By all means, hold on, let me sit back. Go ahead.
So, it's a very brief rant. James Franco is a performer who sometimes has moments like The Disaster Artist. He was brilliant because he was pantomiming some, but like he was a caricature. He disappeared into the character of Tommy Wiseau and did so really, really well. If you want to hear more about our thoughts on that, that's lesson 93.
Look at you. You're
right?
On it.
About The Disaster Artist. But more often than not, James Franco, in my opinion, suffers from the Ben Kingsley sickness. Ben Kingsley is a performer who has an Oscar and sometimes turns in really, really great performances. Most of the time, however, he chooses projects that are very poor decisions and he drives them into the ground because he really, really, really doesn't fit. And I think James Franco, similarly, I don't think that James Franco really... His standout moments are so few and far between for me, but he usually takes something and drives it into the ground.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
100%.
And this film is no different. He's not the only one doing it in this film.
No.
But he definitely, like, his presence in this film and how awful the character is so distracting. Like, it pulls away from anything that the film may have had going for it.
Yeah.
Every time you see him on screen, you're like, oh, gosh, this Joker again. And not like Joker is in the Joker.
No.
Which would be cool.
No, yeah.
But, like, just... you know, ridiculous person.
And plus going back onto this James Franco, you know, bandwagon, his accent was so inconsistent. I was trying to kind of fix on, okay, what is he trying to do here? Is he trying to do like some kind of, cause Detroit doesn't really have a solid accent. Like unless he's like a transplant from like Boston or New York or something, he shouldn't really have like that strong of an accent, and there was a really strong accent he was trying to do, and I struggled to like pay attention to it, and it just failed like miserably. But I think the biggest problem this film has is it tries to create a sense of real life grounding, trying to make it seem like this is a situation that is occurring in real world, but it's more. We've talked about this with Interstellar. I'm pretty sure you'll find the episode. Talked about this with Interstellar. You spend so much time creating this dynamic where you're introducing this science fiction-esque situation into the real world, and then
You transition over and you make it completely science fiction. You make it something completely different, and the transition isn't seamless. You create this right. break between where you lose part of the audience that was tracking the first part of the film. I was like listening. I'm like, all right, I'm really hoping this thing works out, whatever, blah, blah, blah. James Franco sucks. All these things came to mind. And then I got to the point where I'm like, well, yeah, no. Because then people are getting arrested, and the cops coming in, blah, 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 and all this. And I'm like, this is supposed to be a science fiction movie. What's going on? And I struggled with that part, especially when it broke in the middle of the film. It really did.
100%. I totally agree.
What do you think, Spence?
Yeah, no, this movie's garbage. Especially, like, once we get into the end sequence of the movie, especially with the police station, where, you know, a police station should probably be a pretty secure place since you're holding criminals there. But James Franco and his gang just roll in and steamroll over the police officers to a point that is just bewildering. Because there's this one where one of the gang members is coming up to like the entrance glass, and like this police officer starts shooting at the bulletproof glass. Like, she's aiming, and I'm like, you're not going to get through that. It's bulletproof.
Right.
And it was bulletproof, and she didn't make it through. And then the person stuck their hand through the little slot and killed her. And I'm like, you work here. You should know this.
Absolutely. Like,
how did you get killed by this guy? You had the advantage. But yeah, like, they like killed all of the police officers somehow, I think.
Apparently Andy Griffith and Barney Fife weren't on, you know, weren't on patrol that night.
Barney Fife would have handed them their behinds.
Oh, 100%.
Without firing a shot.
Because I don't know what happened, but apparently that place was filled with police, and then the scene transitioned somewhere else, and they go back, and everybody's gone.
Yeah. And, like, literally no casualty whatsoever for James Franco's people. Like, not even a flesh wound of any kind. Nothing.
By the
his
police.
People completely survived storming a police station and slaughtering the police in that station.
Which you would think they would have, like, higher-powered weapons. Mm-hmm. They would have body protection or body armor. They're police. You know, aren't they supposed to be walking around with a bulletproof vest and all that kind of stuff? You would expect all that stuff to be, like, normal.
Well, they had to cut through the wall to get to where most of them were.
Yeah, they had time.
They had, like, this wireless door cutter, too. There was so much going on in this movie. It's like, all right.
Very weird.
This hillbilly has some connections because, you know, not only does he pee on the floor, but he owns, like, really high-end machinery like this. Yeah, that was about the part where it just started getting ridiculous. It started getting silly for me. Mm-hmm. And it just, I don't know, man. I think this film, had it been, because it only sits, you said it only sits at about an hour and a half.
Over an hour and a half, mm-hmm. Yeah.
This film felt like it was 2 hours long.
Felt like it was 5 hours long.
It did. Okay. It felt like it was 5 hours long. It was too long. And I want, for it being only an hour and a half, I still wanted it shorter. I think this film should have stayed as a short.
Yeah, I mean, it was a 20-minute long story told over the course of an hour and 30-something minutes.
With a stripper with a heart of gold.
Just such poor life decisions.
As we wrap this thing up,
let's... By the way, I do have the answer to your question earlier. Interstellar was less than five.
Less than five. There you go. So, yeah.
It's got a fetching picture of Matthew McConaughey and Admiral Akbar from Star Wars.
That was when producer Corey Vincent was doing our artwork.
It's a trap.
So as we wrap this thing up, I think my biggest draw from this particular film was when you're creating content, when you're creating media, when you're creating film, you want to be able to make sure you do right by the source material. We've talked about that before with comic book movies. We talk about it with novel adaptations. Whenever you create a film and there's source material to it, you want to bring honor to it. You want to give homage to it. You want to make sure that you actually, you know, paint a better picture than what that did. Because that's the whole point of it. That's the whole reason why you're making it into a bigger feature, bigger film, because you want to do better. You want to use that as the stepping stone to getting to where you are now. And I think this kind of went backwards. This actually made me feel like, all right, this was garbo. I didn't really want
to finish through the credits. There probably may have been like an end credit scene. Who knows?
I do believe your first words when the credits started were "Let me out of here."
It was between what was happening in front of us and the guy who was growling behind us,
who answered his phone in the middle of the movie and nobody stopped him.
So we've talked about this before. I usually get upset when people talk in the middle of movies.
He shushed
a baby once in a movie.
I did, and I'm proud of it. Mm-hmm. I thought this guy was going to be an issue. I really did.
I could see you were like revving up for something.
I was, and then this movie started going, and I'm like, you know what? I'll listen to what he's saying behind me. I'm pretty sure he's saying something more interesting than what I'm seeing in front of me. Then this man got a phone call, and I'm like, yeah, I'll let him talk. I'll listen to what he's saying. What's he saying? Who's he talking to?
There's nothing going on on screen.
And that's sadly how I felt with this film. I mean, I felt like there had to have been more, and it didn't reach it. It was running this race, and it stopped short a quarter away from the goal. It could have been better. It could have been one of those types of films that could have really like shined in the sci-fi genre. It could have been the next jewel on the sci-fi crown of the 2000s of this century. It could have been something like that. It could have been a contender, you know.
About to go that way, but I didn't need to. You were there. And that's one of the things that's so disappointing. It's not like like The Meg, right? You don't go into a movie like The Meg, which is a big budget B movie, and expect like true greatness. But something like this could definitely be one of those weird, like out of left field, wow, that was really well done. Mm-hmm. Like you can see the potential in it while you're watching it squander the potential that you see.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what makes it such a disappointing experience, because you can see that it could have been something good.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's like belligerently not.
Yeah. And I think going back to what we were saying about Interstellar, the sole issue of this film is its inability to commit. If it committed to being one thing, it should have stayed committed to that throughout the entire film. If it wanted to be a B movie, it should have committed to being like a sci-fi B-ish type of movie. And that would have been fine. I would have gotten it a little bit better, would have understood, okay, they're trying to be ridiculous. James Franco's pissing all over the place. I get it. Cool. You know, I understand. But it didn't commit, and it didn't make me commit to the story. Plain and simple.
Well, and if you want to even go so far as to say, like, pick what you want to be, I think that there are whole, like, I don't know, 70% of the dialogue and the plot progression points could be completely excised, removed from this story. Take the good 30% that remains and then get better people to write it.
Yeah.
I think that there was a lot, especially in the opening, like, not credit sequence, but it was the credit sequence. But like the opening sequence, there was a lot of promise. There was a lot mm-hmm. of potential there. Like some of the angles were interesting, the way that they focus on key details and then zoom out and show bigger things, and some aerial shots that were really compelling.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot that was there that was like, oh, this could be an interesting one after all. And mm-hmm. then you get to the sort of run of the mill medium shots, wide shots, and close ups of the actors.
Yeah.
The dialogue is garbage. The performances are lackluster, and there are entire characters and beats that don't have to be there, that shouldn't be there, that are way too cliche, just filling time.
Yeah, they had to give back the drone. That's why. So
yeah, we only had it for 8 hours.
What about you, Spence? Any last thoughts before we wrap this thing up? Come on, let us have it.
Okay, I want to talk about the end of this
Thank
movie.
You. I was hoping you would.
Because this is the part of the movie where I was like, wait, what is happening right now? Because I stopped paying attention and was listening to people behind me for a second.
That's on it.
So real quick, this is where we get into spoiler territory. So if you haven't seen the film, too late.
It's not going to matter to you.
Yeah, it really isn't. So the otherworldly biker gang like catches up to our heroes, if you will.
Sorry.
They're approaching the police station. The police and the FBI are teaming up to take them out, but bullets are doing nothing to these guys.
Yeah, they're literally wearing fabric
and the bullets are bouncing off the fabric.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
so you know.
And the biker gang, by the way, is two individuals, yeah. not a gang.
Yeah, I don't know why the synopsis says gang.
Just continue. Go ahead.
So they reach into their pocket. They throw this grenade that stops time so that they can retrieve the weapon that they've been trying to get back. And this is the part of the movie where I was like, okay, you know, the aliens like somehow communicate lightly and take back the gun and then they're out of there. That's what I thought was going to happen. But no, one of them takes off their mask and it's Michael B. Jordan. And I'm like, I didn't realize he was in this movie in the slightest. And then he launches into this
this story. Promotion for Creed 2. I mean, wait, go ahead. Just.
Into the story about like, two like races at a war on a different planet, and the main kid is from this other planet, and one day he'll be ready to help him fight in the war because they're brothers. And then he takes the gun and he leaves, and I was like, what? Why were you not here earlier? Why was this not mentioned at all? Why were we stuck on regular Earth and not this other world with the fighting? That sounds like it could be going somewhere. Although, based on this movie, I would think it probably wouldn't be going anywhere.
No, probably not.
There's literally a scene in this movie where they rob a cow farm, guys. Seriously, that's a scene in the movie.
Now, to be fair, there was an illegal poker hall set up in this cow farm.
Ah, so whatever. But that's the unique thing about this film in terms of that particular scene that you mentioned. It would have been better had it had a little bit more foundation in what it revealed at the end throughout the film. Like, if there was a reason for me to continue, other than just them chasing them. Like, take Predator, for instance. The movie Predator, there is a creature that is going after Arnold Schwarzenegger throughout the entire movie. What I know is that he is on his way to go and find them. And when they meet, they fight. These guys just show up, investigate, steal bikes, roll past cops, you know, as they're getting shot at, and then just be like, oh, by the way, we're family. Hey, how's it going? Like, it seemed like a cop-out to me. Like, it just seemed like, for what it was already committing to, that end scene made it, I don't know, it made it a little worse for me, because it's like, okay, well, now you're trying to bait me into hoping that they're going to make another film so that way I can see the continuation of that story, when this story currently was no good. I didn't like it.
Yeah, you didn't earn a sequel.
Exactly. Yeah. And just because it was Michael B. Jordan's face doesn't mean anything to me. It's just, I mean, and obviously, like Chad had mentioned to me earlier, he was an executive producer.
He's one of the executive producers of the film, yeah.
And that's great and all, but I you know what? That, shame on you, from me, is like, I don't think that deserved to happen. I don't think that should have happened. I think that should have been something that you hinted at and left for the next film. Like, because to do that, it's like feeding somebody garbage all week, and then on Sunday, you give them a piece of steak, and you're like, if you behave, tomorrow I'll give you another piece of steak, and you feed them garbage again, and then you give them a steak. It's like, I get it. You've fed me all this garbage, and you're giving me this piece of steak in hopes that tomorrow it's not going to be garbage. It's going to be more steak. I don't think it's going to work out that way for me, and it just doesn't. So that's how I feel about that.
Yeah.
That's a good analogy.
Thank you. I try from time to time. You know?
It's good, yeah.
So, as we wrap up, let's go ahead and go around the table and see if this film passes or fails and how many monocles, starting with Mr. Lost in Space himself, Spencer Williams.
Pass or fail. I'm going to fail this movie, despite the fact that it actually had some like good shots in the beginning. Like, mm-hmm. The opening was very nice. It had like some really good soundtrack, good shots, and the kid was like still a good actor, so I think because of that I'll give it a 1 out of 5.
Oh, well, okay. What about you, Chad?
A pity point,
right?
I'm gonna do the same thing. I'm gonna fail it and give it 1, because there were some redeemable elements that I would not say are worth the ticket price. Don't feel like you need to see those elements, but there were a few accomplished technical aspects that worked if you view them in isolation from the entire story. So for those professionals who worked on the film, I give you 1 monocle.
There you go.
And the kid was pretty good.
True, the kid was good. This film fails for me as a sci-fi film, as just a cohesive film altogether. From a film standpoint, it fails. But from a sci-fi standpoint as well, it fails indubitably, because of the fact that it just didn't hold water. It didn't create a cohesive story, and it had James Franco in it. So, all in all, I think I'm gonna have to give it half a monocle. Like, not even a full monocle. The kid was good, but he wasn't that good. I give it half for him. I'll give him a quarter for him and a quarter for the cows that had to act in that particular scene. So, but that about
you're a generous man.
Thank you. I figured that about wraps up another awesome episode. Remember, if you have any opinions on this episode or any previous episode, drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/FromLossifers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/FromLossify101. We want to hear your thoughts. Before we go, let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got The Nun, which Chad is super stoked about.
Nope.
And Peppermint. So get out to your local movie theaters.
Which I am super stoked about.
Peppermint, that's right. And check out these films and let us know what you think. This was an interesting conversation. And so hopefully, you know what, somebody will listen and be like, you know what, they're right. We need to pull this movie from the shelves. We're not going to play this in our theater. Boycott Kin. That's a lot. Never mind. Scratch that. But it is late. So, from all of us here at the Filmlossifers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.